agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to the Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney and defender of freedom, Jay Carson.
Hey, good evening, Mike.
Hey, Jay, we are recording a little bit early today. I had a family issue, and Jay graciously agreed at the end of his hardworking day working for, freedom and justice in the world, is recording with me this evening. So thank
you for that. It ain't easy.
You know, it's a never-ending battle, isn't it? Hey, before we get started, I want to let folks know, you probably at this point are seeing a new Politics Guys logo. So if you don't see the normal caricature thing that we've been using for the last few years. That's been replaced now by a symbol of a blue and a red hand shaking, which we thought was appropriate. And so we hope you like it. We do. Just so you should know that. Also, we haven't done a listener survey since 2018, which seems like just yesterday, but it's been quite a while. And listener surveys are really helpful every once in a while to give us a sense of who you are, and also what sort of things you like and would like to see us do more of, or maybe would like to see us do less of, or just general ideas. It only will take a few minutes to fill out. We really appreciate it. I will put the link in the show notes. So that would be a huge help to us. Thank you very much in advance for that. Now, today we're going to be talking about, a bunch of things. It's just over a year since January 6th of 2021, the Capitol riot. We're going to talk about that, the Electoral Count Act, which is definitely related, some information about the Fed's latest meeting, inflation and perhaps raising of interest rates, Chief Justice Roberts' year-end report on the judicial branch, Marjorie Taylor Greene's Twitter ban, and the larger issue of Twitter bans and the emerging conservative social media, networks, I guess you could say, and a whole bunch of listener questions we have as well that we haven't gotten to in a while we're looking forward to. So before we get to that, we will take a quick break and we will be right back to kick things off. This week marks the one-year anniversary of the Capitol riot, where a group of thousands of largely Trump supporters stormed the United States Capitol building, delaying certification of the presidential election until the rioters and the riot adjacent, I suppose you could say, could be cleared from the site and order restored to the Capitol. Now, in his public remarks on the anniversary day from Statuary Hall in the Capitol, President Biden said, "One year ago today in this sacred place, democracy was attacked, simply attacked. The will of the people was under assault. The Constitution, our Constitution, faced the gravest of threats." And he continued, "For the first time in our history, a president has not just lost an election, he tried to prevent the peaceful transfer of power as a violent mob breached the Capitol. But they failed. And on this day of remembrance, we must make sure that such attack never, never happens again." Now, Biden didn't refer to Trump by name, but he did speak of a president who was sitting in the private dining room of the Oval Office in the White House, watching it all on television and doing nothing for hours as police were assaulted, lives at risk, the nation's capital under siege. And he referred to Trump as seeing his own interest as more important than his country's interest and America's interest. Biden called it an armed insurrection by those who weren't looking to uphold the will of the people. They were looking to deny the will of the people. And that this isn't about being bogged down in the past. This is about making sure the past isn't buried. Now, that's one view of it, certainly. But on the other hand, you have folks like, Fox News' Tucker Carlson, who, in his remembrance of the day, said, not a lot happened on that day. And it was really only just a riot, maybe just barely. So there you go. Now, Jay, I thought before we start discussing this look back, I wanted to give folks just a very brief refresher on the timeline we're talking about, because I think that's important, right? It started out at noon on January 6, 2021, where thousands of Trump supporters gathered to hear the president insist that the election was stolen from him. And Trump told the crowd, "All Vice President Pence has to do is send it back to the states to recertify, and we become president, and you are the happiest people." And he also encouraged the crowd to go to the Capitol building after his speech to, in his words, peacefully and patriotically make your voices heard. Now, by 2 p.m., protesters had broken in. The Secret Service moved Mike Pence off the Senate floor. By 2:20, the building was in lockdown. 2:24, we see the first Trump tweet. Mike Pence didn't have the courage to do what should have been done to protect our country and our Constitution. 2:38, Trump tweets calling for protesters to support Capitol Police and law enforcement and urges people to stay peaceful. Just before 3 p.m., rioters break into the Senate chamber. And while we don't know the exact timeline for some of these events, we now have learned that during this period, top Trump aides, his daughter, and, well, a bunch of Fox News people were begging the president to take action. We also know that he got into a screaming match with Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who was calling while literally under siege from the rioters. Now, at 3:36 p.m. that day, a White House spokesperson tweeted that President Trump ordered the National Guard to the Capitol. At 4:17, Trump tweeted a video to supporters. I know your pain. I know you're hurt. We love you. You're very special. You've seen what happens. You've seen the way others are treated. I know how you feel, but go home and go home in peace. Now, that's more than 2 hours after all this started. By 6, the interior of the Capitol was secured and D.C. went under curfew. 6:01, Trump tweets, these are the things and events that happen when the sacred landslide election victory is so unceremoniously and viciously stripped away from great patriots who have been badly and unfairly treated for so long. Go home with love and in peace. Remember this day forever. So there you go. Now, Jay, having had a full year now to process and consider everything that went on that January 6th, and how do you see that day now with a year of kind of reflection? I've mentioned how President Biden characterized it and how Fox News' Tucker Carlson characterized it. What about you?
I would characterize it, I think, sort of the same way I did at the time, and whether that shows a lack of insight or lack of growth on my part, or whether I'm right in the first place, I don't know. And that is, it was definitely a riot. It was definitely a violent attack. I think you're correct in that there were people, there were rioters, and then there were those who were riot adjacent. I don't think it was an insurrection. It's certainly more than, you know, Tucker Carlson's, you know, obviously the idea of, oh, these people are just tourists taking a look around. Clearly, that's not the case. Clearly, a lot of these people were just plain nuts, you know, the QAnon factions. And there was some good reporting that was done earlier in this year that also set sort of a timetable where some of like the Proud Boys and those groups who had planned violence were setting up shop other places than the Oval where President Trump was speaking, and that they had already begun to move forward on this, you know, during the speech. All that said, do I hold Trump culpable for this? In a moral sense, yes. Obviously, he was playing with fire. He was saying things he should have known could lead to this type of violence. He was just plain wrong and delusional, I think, in terms of the whole, you know, the game plan of the Green Bay sweep, as it's called now. Sort of that was the name for this operation.
Well, let me ask you this, Jay, on that, because it seems to me there are at least two issues regarding Donald Trump. And the first would be, well, what culpability, what responsibility does he bear for the attack itself? But then there's the second question of whether or not he failed to act expeditiously enough after it was clear that there was a riot and the Capitol had been breached. And if so, if that constitutes dereliction of duty?
Yes. On the first, like I said, I think he bears some culpability for getting this started, for ginning this up, for pursuing claims that should have been obvious to most everyone are false and meritless. It's hard to say whether he actually thought they're false or meritless,
yeah.
Right? Again, my contention has been he is sort of delusional, and it was just I think you said it well once that the way the way it works in his mind is, I'm a winner. Winners don't lose. Therefore, I could not have lost.
Right. Yeah.
You know,
yep.
Absent,
absolutely.
And that's it. It just might be that simple in his mind. I think I was pretty clear on the record last year when we were talking about impeachment that my game plan for the Democrats would have been to just bring a clean impeachment charge on the dereliction of duty, which I think it was dereliction of duty. I don't think there's any way around that. Not going on TV live or messaging followers immediately saying, no, this is not the way to do this. So I definitely, yeah, I would say he's culpable for dereliction of duty. In issues where you start to get of, well, is this a coup? Is it an insurrection? I would take issue with that kind of characterization.
I wanted to ask you about that because this week, in fact, on Tucker Carlson's show, Ted Cruz came on and Tucker really grilled him about, because earlier Ted Cruz had called it a terror attack. And Carlson really pushed him on that. And Cruz, you know, hoping one day to be sitting in the White House as president, backed up. Called these remarks dumb and ill-considered and all that. And I think Carlson rightly said, you know, you choose words very carefully. I don't buy this for a second. But, you know, if you look at the Code of Federal Regulations about terrorism, the definition is the unlawful use of force and violence against persons or property to intimidate or coerce the government, the civilian population, or any segment thereof in furtherance of political or social objectives. And I read that definition and I think about what at least some people did on January 6th. And I say, well, no, that in fact is terrorism.
I could agree with that for some people.
Yeah. For some people. Absolutely.
The idea that this was though a coordinated terrorist attack, coordinated by Trump or Trump's people and a coup and insurrection. That's where I think, you know, the statements go too far. You know, for example, again, I think it's worth noting that if this was a planned insurrection to overthrow the government, no one was armed. I think they confiscated, you know, maybe a handful of people, if that, who had guns, and other people had maybe had some other weapons. But if you're going to overthrow one of the most powerful governments in the world, and have an insurrection to do that, typically you come better prepared. These are folks who like guns and have access to them.
But I think it's fair to say that just like lack of knowledge of the law doesn't mean that you're not subject to the law. So people could have been acting in a way that fits the definition of terrorism without realizing that. And also being an incompetent lawbreaker doesn't mean you're not still a lawbreaker.
No, agreed. And I'm not disputing that these folks are lawbreakers.
Hundreds of them, right?
Where I would dispute is I would say, look, maybe some might be subject to a terrorism charge. I think plenty would be subject to disorderly conduct and trespassing and, you know, interrupting, you know, public business and vandalism and, you know, all these host of things of which people have been charged. And I think they should be prosecuted to the fullest extent that the facts will permit. But again, the sense that this was an attempt to overthrow the government, and it probably was in maybe a couple of people's minds. But I don't know that it's helpful when you know a President Biden, you know, and the media speaks of this always as an insurrection. Again, there can be a middle ground where you can say this was a riot, this was disgraceful, this was one of the darkest days, certainly of the 21st century and in American history, and one of a dark day for American democracy, without it being treason and an insurrection. That may be just the lawyer in me coming out that, look, certain charges and certain words have certain meanings.
No, absolutely. As does terrorism. And I think people are, especially people who like Ted Cruz would be understandably reluctant to pin that to himself. So it is kind of odd that he chose that particular word, given the negative connotation, because, of course, to a lot of people on the right, the story, the alternate reality is that the real insurrection was on Election Day. And right. This was just simply patriots rising up to take back their government. And so to call that terrorism is just anathema to those folks.
Yeah, no, and I get that. I mean, no one likes getting called a terrorist.
Yeah, no.
And look, by the definition that you read, you can easily make the argument too that someone who is at a say a Black Lives Matter march throws a brick through a window, that would also fit that same bill. Now, would that person be a terrorist? Yeah. Be charged with terrorist? Now, look, maybe their conduct fills out that statute. But I think in most cases people would sure. not jump and say that, aha, terrorism.
Yeah.
Right.
I think that's a good point.
It would be more the lesser charges of vandalism, disorderly conduct, destruction of property, and, you know, rioting, all those other things.
But I think that's important to point out. But I think there's also perhaps a lot of people would argue, and I think rightly so, a clearer link between vandalism as part of some kind of social justice, whatever it is, protest, it doesn't matter what the group is, and somebody actually specifically marching to and illegally entering the Capitol building specifically at a very specific time with a very specific intent to stop a particular government operation involving the peaceful transfer of power. I mean, that's about as direct a linkage of political terrorism as you can get.
Yes, and if the facts bear out, some of those people should be charged with that. But something else that I want to, because this is something that's been kicking around in my head for a while, with a lot of this information that's come out through the January 6th Commission, and it's often reported, you know, breathlessly by MSNBC as, aha, here's the memo that shows the plan that Trump was planning to you know, have a coup. He was planning to take over the country and all this stuff. And what we've seen is with this Green Bay sweep plan is, one, it was a terrible plan. But secondly, I don't think that's treason, terrorism, insurrection. It's when you ask your lawyers, hey, what options do I have to contest the election?
Yeah, let's game plan this. And people come up with a variety of things. And some of them are really off the wall. And there were some people in Donald Trump's orbit who were more off the wall than normal. So I agree with you on this.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's off the wall planning. But it's one thing to say, listen, hey, there's this goofy act from 1877. You know, maybe if we got Pence to say these, you know, states aren't eligible, maybe that works. And that's goofy as hell, I think is how I've described it before and how I would continue to describe it. But it's also different than, hey, let's call the generals and, you know, we're seizing the country by military force.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, you mentioned the House committee and, they mentioned this week that they plan to release the final report before the midterm elections. And they're still waiting, I believe, on that Supreme Court ruling to get the Trump records that they requested about that. We talked about that executive privilege claim. Adam Schiff, who's a member of the committee, says that public hearings could start, well, anywhere from a matter of weeks to a matter of months. And I know initially you said that you thought that there was really no point in this committee, this commission. Now, a lot of folks would say, well, look at all we see, maybe not smoking guns. And I agree with you on the planning things, having a plan or having somebody draw up a PowerPoint is a very different thing from implementing a plan. But things like getting a better sense of the timeline and what the president knew and when he knew it, once the rioting had actually taken place, to me, it seems like that's something that has a certain very real value, even if for people who are maybe considering whether or not they're going to support Donald Trump if he runs in 2024, people who are, well, Trump adjacent.
Yeah, no, I think there is value from just the historical perspective of this, right? more information. And look, it's fascinating stuff, right? To be able to have that view into what was really going on in the Oval Office, you know, during this time. And is it fascinating? Yes. Does that change how my sense is the January 6th report was written probably more or less by January 8th of last year, right? We know what it's going to say.
The general conclusions, absolutely.
Yeah, you know, the evidence be damned. So I think my thing is that
– let me pull back and, you know, shortly after all of that happened, Mitch McConnell, who is certainly no rhino, said on the Senate floor, President Trump is practically and morally responsible for provoking the events of the day. The leader of the free world cannot spend weeks thundering that shadowy forces are stealing our country and then feign surprise when people believe him and do reckless things. I mean,
that's sort of like what I just said.
And you know, Kevin McCarthy said right after the event, Trump bears responsibility for what happened. So this is not a partisan conclusion to reach, or at least it wasn't in the immediate aftermath. But as we saw with Ted Cruz scrambling wildly to disavow his earlier remarks, we've seen, I think a lot of folks on the left believe what we've seen is a lot of the leadership of the Republican Party scramble away from those remarks. For instance, in April of 2021, not too long after these events, the Republican National Republican Senatorial Committee actually created a special new award, Champion of Freedom, so they could give it to Donald Trump.
Have I been nominated?
Yeah, you know, but I think a lot of folks, and I would agree, feel that Liz Cheney has it right. Not quite a week ago, she said, our party has to choose. We can either be loyal to Donald Trump or we can be loyal to the Constitution. We cannot do both. And right now, there are far too many Republicans who are trying to enable the former president. And you know, I'm not a Republican anymore, and so it's easy for me to say, yeah, you go, Liz Cheney. What do you think about Cheney's position and just the general sense, at least to a lot of people on the left, that the right, that not just the far right, but that a lot of establishment Republicans are enabling the president? You have Mitch McConnell, who after he made those remarks, said, you know, well, would you support him if he's the party's nominee? And he said one word, absolutely. And so that causes a lot of people's heads to spin, I think, on the left. So
I think this is one of those situations where, you know, say you have the crazy uncle, your own crazy family member, you're often quite comfortable criticizing him and saying all sorts of nasty things within your own family. But when someone from the outside starts doing so, there's a tendency to circle the wagons. And I think that there's part of that going on, right? Part of it was the immediacy of one, this is awful and it should be condemned. And the second piece was then when, you know, the Democrats started we're going to have a commission, we're going to investigate, we're going to do this. And there was sort of this, you know, it's going to be the political kabuki theater. There is a tendency to say, oh, no, come on. I'm going to, at this point, kind of go back and support the guy who I just criticized, defend him from criticism from the other side. I think that's just kind of a natural thing that happens. Because to some extent, these representatives and senators see themselves to some extent, they're always tied to Trump, right? Because he's in the same party and Trump had nominally been the head of the party as president.
Well, I want to suggest that it's more than about Trump. And here's what I mean. I get a real sense more and more of sort of a Sorcerer's Apprentice type of vibe from all of this, that Donald Trump unleashed forces that nobody really can control. I mean, we saw when Trump came out and said positive things about vaccines, he was booed, you know? And I think Trump may be the face of this populist rage, right-wing populist rage sort of thing. But I think it's a response not just to, well, Donald Trump is, you know, the leader of the party still, but that we recognize the power of this force and we go against it at our own peril, our own political peril.
There's some of that, but I would tell you, I don't think Mitch McConnell's worried about getting primaried.
Well, I mean, his approval, right? Yeah, his approval ratings, I think, at an all time low. But and maybe you're right about that. But yeah. So you know, I want to talk about the sort of larger forces, some things I want to run by you. Before I do, we just want to take a quick break, and we will get back and talk about that. So yeah, Jay, you know, I wanted to get into some of these, the bigger picture of this. You know, there's this whole idea of essentially to be a, at least among some people, to be a Republican in good standing, you have to believe what we on the left, and I think a lot of centrists call the big lie, right? That the Republican, yeah. that the nomination was stolen. And this is not an uncommon belief. A recent PRRI poll found that 68% of Republicans either mostly or completely agree that the 2020 presidential election was stolen for Trump, and 40% of them completely agree. Now, for people who say in the survey that they mostly trust Fox News, 82% mostly or completely agree the election was stolen, with 47% completely agreeing. Now, if you compare that to 2016, according to a Gallup poll that was released shortly after that election, 76% of Clinton voters accepted Trump as the legitimate president. And so this just isn't...
That was before they heard about the Russians.
Well, this isn't just in the general public. This we see supposedly responsible people who are pushing this. And it's not just Tucker Carlson, what I'm saying, though you can argue that he is the most influential conservative voice who's not an office holder at this point. But take, for instance, in our own state of Ohio,
present company excluded.
Yeah, well, yeah, of course. Josh Mandel, who right now is, I would say, the odds-on favorite to replace Rob Portman as one of Ohio's U.S. senators, he has repeatedly and proudly said that the election was stolen from Donald Trump. And again, he's just one example. There are plenty of them. So it seems to me that this is, you know, and you, the reason I mentioned 2016 is in the past, we've talked about this and you've mentioned, well, there are Democrats who felt that, you know, not my president. And you're absolutely right. But I think we're seeing this at a far greater level now. And I think in part because back then there were maybe a few people you mentioned. Whenever I think of this, I think of Maxine Waters because you like to bring her up for obvious reasons.
She injects herself into a lot of things.
Yeah, exactly. But this to me is being done at a scale being, well, in Liz Cheney's words, enabled at a scale that we've never seen before. And it's concerning to me. And I wanted to get your take on that.
I'm not sure. You know, it's a tough question to answer because there's sort of the Pauline Kael effect, right? And you probably know what I'm talking about.
I do. But our listeners
know. Yeah. Pauline Kael was a film critic for the New York Times in the 60s, 70s, and famously responded after Nixon was elected, I can't believe he won. Nobody I know voted for him. Or I didn't say that exactly right. I don't know anyone who voted for him.
Yeah, exactly.
But it sort of goes to people's bubbles. And in my bubble, I don't see that those people saying the election was stolen. I do hear people saying, and I say it myself, that there were things that were certainly troublesome about the 2020 election. We're looking at you, Pennsylvania, in terms of things that, you know, part of it was COVID, and there were special procedures and things that would not have been done otherwise. And now they're becoming routine and so forth. And I think, as I say all the time, there's fraud in every election. Does it raise to the level of changing the result? Very rarely. In this case, I don't think there's certainly in this case, there's been evidence of people who fraudulently voted for Trump. I think I've been pretty clear about this, that to the extent there were any shenanigans, it was nowhere near close to being able to alter the count in any of the states that would have mattered. And that's sort of the crowd I tend to run with, right? That we say, listen, we have legitimate concerns about election integrity. But that's not the same thing as saying the election was stolen from Trump.
And that was the crowd that was essentially running the Republican Party until fairly recently. I mean, that's the crowd that I think is exemplified by people like, for instance, Senator Rob Portman. And but we're seeing, I think, less of, you know, we're seeing people like Portman, well, retiring and being potentially replaced, you know, Godspeed to Tim Ryan. But I mean, I think it's going to be Josh Mandel or J.D. Vance. God, talk about your poison there, you know. So
Mike, just this afternoon, I got a text from Jame Timken. Saying that she thinks the Ohio Senate race, Senate primary, is in a dead heat.
Well, okay.
I don't really know, but that's what she texted me. So
between bad and worse, I don't know. But the two front anyway. But my point being, right, that this is, to me, the concern is that outside that your bubble used to be much more representative of the sort of center of gravity.
That's probably true.
Of the party.
Then the other piece that I would add, and I always throw this in, although I don't, with the kind of numbers you're talking about on the surveys, I don't know how much of a difference it makes. Is something that's fun about Republicans is they love to lie to mostly Democratic pollsters.
But on this,
the numbers are pretty striking.
Yeah, and you know, and it's not just that. I think it was the same poll. PRI asked about belief in conspiracy theories like QAnon-ish kind of stuff and that sort of thing, because these two things oftentimes will. Right. Travel together. And just a few things that really struck me that are of concern to me, at least 21% of the respondents believe that there is a storm coming soon that will sweep away the elites in power and restore the rightful leaders. 18% believe that the government, media, and financial worlds in the U.S. are controlled by a group of Satan-worshipping pedophiles who run a global child sex trafficking operation. And 18% said they believe that because things have gotten so far off track, true American patriots may have to resort to violence in order to save our country. And that number rises to 30% for Republicans and 32% for those who mostly trust Fox News. I mean, those are not insignificant percentages.
I might argue that you may have 20% of the population that's their mindset, and on any given day.
But I mean, if say like close to a third of Republicans believe that, well, it's getting to be the time where we're going to have to resort to violence.
The storm's coming, Mike.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know,
no, I think that strikes me as high and strikes me as concerning.
I mean, and I hope, you know, I hope you're right about all this. We've talked about this before, and I think you have a much more sanguine sort of view of it, believing that, you know, the Trump wave will sort of recede now that he's out of office and so forth. And
well, I think it already is.
But it seems to me that like I said, that the kind of sorcerer's apprentice thing that I'm seeing is he's unleashed these forces that I think are not going to be controlled. But again, I really hope that I'm wrong and you're right about this.
That said, but what I'm saying is I do know plenty of people. I don't know if I'd say myself included, but if you got a phone call saying, do you believe that the world is controlled by Satan, satanic pedophiles engaged in child trafficking and the financial world, the political world? My answer to that is absolutely.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Sometimes I think the poll questions are, I think people are pulling their chains.
Sure. Well, I mean, and there may be some people, but
besides what, you know, look.
Well, I think we're going to get it.
Jeffrey Epstein, Ghislaine Maxwell, and the Lincoln Project. Sort of make it tough to argue that none of that ever happened.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, and I think it's important to point out that, and we've talked about this before, right now I think Donald Trump has endorsed somewhere around 100 candidates for the midterms. And we're going to get much more of a sense of how strong Trumpism and Trump's name and brand are when we see the results of those Republican primaries and then those general elections, I think. So yeah.
Remember the second time Ross Perot ran?
Yeah, not too
no,
well,
no one else
right?
Does.
Because exactly, yeah. All right. Well, let's move on from there and talk about something that is, well, pretty clearly related, I would say. And that's the Electoral Count Act. I mean, the reason the Capitol was focused on January 6th was Congress's role in certifying the election results. Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution requires that the President of the Senate shall, in the presence of the Senate and House of Representatives, open all the certificates, and the vote shall then be counted. The person having the greatest number of votes shall be the president. Now, after the contentious presidential election of 1876, when there were competing sets of electors in four states, Congress passed the Electoral Count Act of 1887, took them a while, in an attempt to clarify what would happen in these instances. But unfortunately, there's bipartisan consensus that this is a pretty poorly worded piece of legislation. Now, the intent, it seems,
there are a number of outlets have reprinted it in its entirety.
Oh,
and it's fun to read.
Yeah, I read through it. It made me scratch my head. Exactly. You know, written by a committee that was, I don't know, drunk or what have you. But I mean, the intent, I think, was to provide a mechanism to deal with competing elector situations. But that certainly wasn't made clear in the wording. And so long as one member of the House and one senator dispute results from a state's electors, each chamber has to consider and vote on whether or not to uphold that dispute and can count those electors. Now, and this is where you get into bad plans. We talked about this earlier. Apparently, the Trump plan, and folks, follow me here, the logic's going to get a little strained, revolved around Congress voting to deny certification in enough states to then deny Biden an Electoral College majority, presumably then throwing the election into the House, where each state delegation gets one vote. And since a majority of those delegations are controlled by Republicans, that would make it possible for Trump to be voted president by the House. Now,
and you people will be very happy.
That wouldn't happen for a bunch of reasons. The main reason it wouldn't happen is that Democrats had a majority in the House, and so the two chambers wouldn't have agreed to not certify the states. And in cases where there is a disagreement between the House and the Senate, the tiebreaker is whatever electors the governor of the state certified. So, and even if it happened that way, the Electoral Count Act would have been challenged in court, and a number of people believe it's unconstitutional, as it kind of in effect seems to give Congress a power that the Constitution gives pretty clearly to the states. And the reason I bring this up is it's important to keep in mind because, you know, a lot of media point out that 147 Republicans in Congress voted to not certify electors in at least one state. But it was in effect what we called before a free vote, meaning that they knew there would be no direct consequences for voting to not certify, but in their minds, and I think rightly so, plenty of potential electoral consequences for voting to certify. So recently, around this anniversary, there's been a lot of talk about reforming the Electoral Count Act, and some like
we're abolishing it all.
Yeah,
together,
the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal says it's unconstitutional; it should simply be just repealed. Others are suggesting things like, well, wording that clearly indicates the vice president is an announcer of votes and not a decider of which votes count, or maybe doing things like raising the bar of objections to certification before you can call for a vote of each chambers. And there is seem to be some Republican support for this. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Minority Whip John Thune have said, well, it's worth considering. McConnell said, you know, there are some clearly some problems with the Electoral Count Act. Whereas many Democrats at least seem to think that it's kind of a feint by Republicans to draw attention away from broader election changes that Democrats would like to pass. So I guess I have two questions for you, Jay, at least two questions.
All right.
First,
question one.
Do you think that the Electoral Count Act should be reformed or repealed?
Yes and yes.
Okay. So you would go with repeal then?
Either or. I would take either or, but I'd prefer repealed.
Yeah. Okay. And so you're with the Wall Street Journal editorial board on that.
The Wall Street Journal editorial board is with me. Yes.
Okay.
Usually I get the privilege of I say something on the show on the weekend and then Monday's editorial, you know, reflects that. So it shows they're listening, but, I would say I tend to agree with the Wall Street Journal editorial board probably 9 out of 10 times, and it's because we're both sort of that center right sort of sensibility.
Yeah, but, definitely. I mean, I
even if the editorial board of Wall Street Journal had not so opined, I think that would still be the right answer.
Yeah.
That it ought to be abolished.
Yeah, I think that's the simpler answer and the cleaner solution to this sort of thing. And you know, I can at least even if it's not abolished, I can at least potentially see some sort of change because
repealed is probably the word. It's a late day Friday.
There you go. But I mean, Congress doesn't want, no one in Congress wants a repeat of January 6th. And if they can make it clear that the responsibility doesn't lie with them, they might be inclined to do that. Congress has a long history of trying to not take responsibility for all kinds of things. We've talked about this how many times on the show? More times than I can count, right? So I could see where that would be politically appealing, right? We want it taken out of our hands, as it should be. But on the other hand, I think Democrats may not allow it to go forward as a standalone thing, as I mentioned before, because they don't want to seem like, well, they want to give Republicans the ability to say, well, see, we've done something about elections and democracy, when that would really be just kind of covering up what a lot of folks on the left, myself included, see as being much larger systemic issues with elections. So I tend to think that nothing probably will happen on this, just because it's just too hot of an issue. And I just don't end up seeing, I just don't see enough Democrats going along to kind of make this happen. I don't know. That's what I think politically. What do you think?
I mean, here's the easy thing, right? If you're the Democrats, just put that in the your election bill.
I'm sure that will be.
Has to be passed. And then you can say, hey, look, Republicans, we had a clear, you know, people who said they would vote for this, and you know, make them work, right? I mean, you have to vote against it and all that.
I wouldn't be surprised if that happens. I mean, Schumer's mentioned that they're really going to put the full court press on Manchin to try to get to be the necessary Manchin and Sinema to be the votes to, you know, at least change the filibuster for that. From what I heard is they even have Oprah talking to him. And I mean, if Oprah can't convince them, you know, who can, right?
Just the game plan. They're not getting it.
I don't see it. I don't see any of this happening, just simply because I think the Democrats are going to push for a go big or nothing, basically. And the Democrats and Joe Manchin isn't going to budge on this. I say this a lot. I hope I'm wrong, certainly. And I hope
he's floated sort of your proposal of sort of having this, returning the speaking filibuster.
Yeah. I don't know. I think in the end, nothing's going to happen.
Reforming the filibuster to require the speaking.
Yeah. Yeah. I think nothing's going to happen on any of this, and we're not going to see any significant reforms, electoral reforms or vote counting reforms on the federal level. And so we'll go into 2022 and then 2024 with, you know, just, well, we'll see what happens, but I don't know if it's going to be good. So,
well, here's my hypothetical that I've been thinking about, and this is what concerns me about the Electoral Count Act. Let's say we're in December or early January of 2025, and they're counting the votes. And let's say hypothetically it's a Biden Trump rematch. I don't think it will, but let's just say for the purposes of this conversation, it is. And they come along you have representatives from, say, Texas and Georgia or other people who say, listen, these electoral results should not be counted because we have abhorrent voting laws. You can only vote by during a certain time of the year, and you can't do it from your car at 3 a.m. and so forth. But they're absolutely un-American, and these results are flawed. Those states' electors should not be counted. What say you, Vice President Kamala Harris? I mean, that to me is very much a concern. It sort of echoes what House Democrats did in 2004, or I guess it would have been 2005 with the Bush reelection, where stood on the floor and said, no, it's because the voting machines were fixed and so forth, which was crazy then. And it's crazy now, just as Trump's claims about the Venezuelans and all that was crazy then. Yeah. And crazy now. But I guess for people on the left, I think it's an interesting thought experiment, right? Because, and I'm not so much talking to you, Mike, but for others who are
sure.
out there, who it would insist that the Green Bay sweep is necessarily a coup or an insurrection or so forth. What if it was turned around the other way and Democrats were saying, we're not going to count these votes because we believe the result is necessarily tainted by racist voting laws?
Yeah. And I think, or
the other hypothetical, Mike, is let's, the counterfactual back in history. It's 1960. And Democrats say, and they could rightfully, say, listen, some of these southern states, we don't think their electors should be counted because there was not a full and fair vote. There were millions of people who were denied the right to vote. And they were, and they would have been right. So would those dissenters in 1960 have been guilty of a coup or an insurrection in trying to undo the vote?
Yeah, and I think
discuss among yourselves.
I think those are important hypotheticals, and I think the larger point here is that these are things that need to be decided in advance and not in the heat of the moment when the pressure is on, which is why it's good to have clear lines in place about, well, if the state certifies the vote, then those are the electors that are counted, and the duty of Congress and the vice president, it's a ministerial duty. They're just announcing it. That's just like you can be a Grammy announcer and you don't get to choose, who the winner is. That's what I'm talking about. And so I would be in favor of that. And I think both sides.
I'm in favor of it. I just think spinning this out as to when again, because you have so many Democrats who have used the January 6th commission words about, well, the game planning and the PowerPoints and all that. Well, this is evidence of treason or insurrection or something like that. And I don't know that it is. I think there was a lack of a factual basis to support it. Certainly, and it was a goofy plan from the start.
I think in the end, what happens if in any of those scenarios is that obviously this gets litigated, and I still have maybe more faith than some people do in the Supreme Court to not be. Now, Ken, if he's listening to this, is rolling his eyes because I know he thinks the Supreme Court is hopelessly corrupt for the right. But I would tend to think in those cases the Supreme Court would do the right thing. But it shouldn't have to come to that,
Yeah.
We shall see. Now, with that, we actually come to the end of our free ad-supported segment on the show. And on the full episode, we're going to be talking about all sorts of things I mentioned, the Fed December meeting, inflation, Chief Justice Roberts, speaking of him, there's a year-end report on the state of the judiciary, Marjorie Taylor Greene being banned for Twitter, and larger issues about that, and some listener questions and comments as well. So if you'd like to get a full episode, all the full episodes, which are ad-free and usually run around 2 hours, they're available to our Patreon supporters, as well as to anyone who isn't in a position to financially support the podcast at this point, or anyone just like to maybe try out a full show before becoming a supporter. That'd be fine. To become a Patreon supporter, just go to patreon.com/politicsguys. Patreon is our main support platform. We know some people aren't in the monthly commitment, so you can support us through Venmo. We're at Politics Guys, as well as through PayPal. And all of our support links are in the show notes and at politicsguys.com/support. And if you want to get free access to full episodes, just email me, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will be happy to take care of that for you. And whether you're a supporter or not, we'd really appreciate it if you could subscribe, rate the show, and leave a review on whatever podcast app you use, share episodes. And don't forget that listener survey that is really important to us. We'd really appreciate if you take a few minutes to fill that out. And again, the link is in the show notes.